Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I am AB Dawji, and this, of course, is the big picture. Ahlan wa sahlan. Kaifa? Tamam? Well, it's great to be back again. Yes, 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 yes. I'm sure that all you millions of listeners out there must be wondering why there was no big picture program over the past 2 weeks. I am sure that you were concerned about what happened to me, eh? What was that? Who said, not really? Sure. You people are so cruel, eh? Okay, just because you are so rude, so as punishment, I will bore you with all the details about what happened to me over the past 2 weeks, okay? So, just over 2 weeks ago, I got a phone call from Dr. Nasser Khan. He is an ophthalmologist. Well, in plain language, that means an eye specialist. And he has traveled with me on few of my tours. He was inquiring about my Vietnam tour that's coming up next month. Oh, by the way, if you are planning to join me on this incredible magical tour, you better call me now, because we have very few seats left, and there is a huge discount because the rand has improved and the airline has lowered its fare. So, getting that little bit of free advertising out of the way, let me get back to Nasser Khan. He was inquiring about the Vietnam tour, as I said, and I said to Nasser, "Boss, before I tell you about Vietnam, let me tell you about a big problem I have. Very big problem. I keep arguing with people every day. The whole day, every day. Just arguing and arguing." Well, Nasser was very confused, and he said, "But why? What's the matter?" And I replied, "Boss, the problem is that I can't see eye to eye with people anymore." And he just burst out laughing. And he said, "Hey, please come and see me very quickly, okay? Urgently." So next day, I went up to him, and he checked me, and he said, "Boss, you got cataracts in both eyes." Cataracts? Cataracts? Both eyes? Impossible. That's an old Bali's disease, man. And I am only, let's see, 45, or is it 43 or something like that? How can this happen to me? No, 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 no. There must be some mistake. And Nasser said with a smile, "Come Thursday and we'll sort one eye out. We'll do one eye at a time." Thursday? It was Tuesday. So like day after tomorrow, he's going to cut my eye and take out the lens and put a plastic one inside my eye. And all this will happen, as he said, while I'm fully awake. Good heavens. The idea of this happening gave me the heebie-jeebies. Heebie-jeebies, I tell you. So, but I didn't want to act like a sissy, you see. A bunk brook. And I didn't want to put it off because I knew that I would talk myself out of it. So, I said very bravely to Nasser, I said, "Okay, sharp. I'll check you on Thursday, okay?" Next day, I was very quiet for the whole day, contemplating my upcoming appointment with the hangman. Anyway, to cut a long story short, Thursday, I pitched up at the Amhlanga Eye Hospital. And they put me on a bed, and they wheeled me into the operating theater. Dr. Balim, the anesthetist, was there. And he said, "Hey, I always listen to your program, and now you are here in person. Wow." And I thought, a thought came into my mind. I hope I didn't upset him by anything I said on my program. And he put a needle into my arm and injected something. And 2 seconds later, I felt like I had half a bag of Zol. And while I was awake, they cut into my eye. Yes, they cut into my eye. How loud did I scream? Not at all. Nothing. No pain. Zero. Not the slightest pinprick of pain even. Nothing at all. And then after that, the eye was closed up with some cotton wool and tape. Next day, I went to see Nasser. He took off the patch that covered my eye and he asked me how I feel. Well, I didn't answer him at all. But I burst into song. I can see clearly now the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's going to be a bright, bright, sunshiny day. I tell you, dear listeners, it was like a miracle. I really did not know what a cataract operation was all about, what it meant. I could drive without glasses, and I could watch TV, of course, Islamic programs only, without glasses. Hey, I was really shocked. It was life-changing. All along before, I thought, well, the eyesight is going slowly. That's what old age is all about. Kalas, I just have to accept it. Finished. It's all downhill from now onwards. But nothing of the sort. This is, as I said, a real miracle. Last Thursday, I had the second eye done. Magic. Alhamdulillah. I feel young again. Just need maybe a hair transplant and I'm away, people. And then it's off to the gym to try to get the 2 liter into a 6-pack. I'm on a roll here, folks. On a roll. The biggest problem I have now encountered, folks, is lowering of gaze. Yes, I've always succeeded in the past, but now it will be a real struggle. But I have strong willpower. Make dua for me. But the positive side is that people won't be able to con me anymore. They won't be able to take me for a ride, bluffing me and so on. From now onwards, I'll be able to see right through everyone. Watch out, okay? Anyway, Bayo or Beno, the purpose of all this talk is to encourage people whose vision is a little fuzzy to get checked up. And if you have cataracts, go get it done. Nothing to be scared about. It will change your life, I promise you. And speaking about vision, my friend Solly Suleiman sent me some words of wisdom early this morning when I woke up for Tahajjud. You better believe that. Listen to this. Vision is the art of seeing what is invisible to others. Let me repeat that. Vision is the art of seeing what is invisible to others. Wow, isn't that deep, eh? Ponder on that for a minute and then think about all the great people who had a great impact on this world, the visionaries who had amazing ideas and put them into action. They had the art of seeing what was invisible to others. Nice one, eh? So, while I was in this euphoric state, that's a nice word, right? Euphoric state. I just checked it up this morning to impress you. I met old Mr. Ghafoor Bhai as I was coming out of the masjid on Wednesday. And he said, "Hey, Dawji, where the president giving the speech tomorrow?" I said, "What you mean, Mota? What do you mean, where?" He said, "What's the address? They didn't tell us." And I was confused. "What do you mean, uncle?" And he answered, "They say State of Nation Address, but they don't give address. Where we must go, Dawji?" I said, no, no, Mota. Address means Cyril Ramaphosa is going to give a speech. And he says, yes, 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 okay. But what's the address? Where we have to go? I answered, Uncle, I have to go. My father is hooting for me. Note to self. Avoid Sparks Road and Glennon Road Masjid. So let's look at Sona, the state of the nation address. But first, the word Sona is very appropriate. In Urdu, it means going to sleep. Mujhe sona hai. And I hear that many people try to stay awake through the speech of the president. Some people could not take it anymore and said, Cyril, I'm a posy. Our Cyril Mota is not Julius. Cyril is polished. Very polished. Very nice big words he uses and sounds like a school principal and so on. Julius, on the other hand, has his own down-to-earth style. He connects with people. I heard him a week ago at the EFF big policy rally that they had. The stadium was filled with Reds, if you remember, if you saw that chock-a-block. And he speaks ordinary person's language, down-to-earth, as I said. Hi, Bo. What is this nonsense about small matchbox RDP houses? We're going to give you big houses and the toilets are going to be inside. Imagine Ramaphosa speaking like that. Imagine Ramaphosa saying, hi, Suga, this VAT thing is too high. We're going to make it 14%, okay? You see? Malema got the style. People listen to him and say, he speaks like us. He is one of us. That Cyril, he sounds like the Mlungu. We don't know all his big words. Maybe he is for the Mlungu white monopoly game or something like that. And now we take a break for an English lesson. There is an old English expression. If wishes were horses, beggars would ride. It's actually part of a poem. If wishes were horses, beggars would ride. If tulips were swords, I'd wear one by my side. If ifs and ands were pots and pans, there'd be no need for tinkers and tinkers' hands. Let me read that again, a little better than what I did now. If wishes were horses, beggars would ride. If turnips were swords, I'd wear one by my side. If ifs and ands were pots and pans, there'd be no need for tinkers' hands. But just the first line, if wishes were horses, beggars would ride. In fact, some people say it wrongly, if wishes were horses, pigs would fly. Anyway, what it all means is that if wishes were immediately realizable, if they were real, then things would be wonderful. If all the promises that were made over the past 25 years at the State of the Nation speeches by past presidents, and the promises were kept immediately, then South Africa would by now be like a so-called first world country. Beautifully functioning hospitals, a top-class educational system, no crime whatsoever, good standard of living for everyone, low unemployment, and so on and so on. But sadly, all of the above are in serious decline. Things have been getting steadily worse. Our Cyril seems like he sounds like a good guy, and he looks quite committed, and he wants to fix things up. Some of the things he said sounded promising, but others, very lofty promises, exaggerated promises, seem more like empty ones geared to the upcoming elections, geared to getting votes on the 8th of May. Big promises, which will cost a lot, in fact, all the big promises. And I thought people in Parliament, while he was speaking, would shout, where is the money? Where is the money going to come from? Where is the money going to come from? Yes, of course, you need tons of money to carry out big projects, big promises, to fix up state institutions like the SABC, the ESCOM, SAA, and so on. Hey, they're shouting, where is the money? Where is the money? Or pay back the money. Remember that? Pay back the money. Remind me of something or someone in particular. When the Sona was carrying on the speech by Cyril Ramaphosa, where was Julius Malema? Yes, the red overalls were in Parliament. Yes, there was someone who looked like, and we were told that he was a leader of the EFF. But I think, folks, that he was an imposter. He looked like Julius. But he was very quiet, quiet as a mouse. Chup, not one word. I actually tuned into the president's speech, well, of course, to listen to him, but you know, to be honest, to witness some tamasha, Juju and his Red Brigade creating some sort of chaos, making a big rush and getting carried out by the white shirts, that is the security. So it was something of a disappointment, a letdown. The EFF were very quiet as lambs. There was a big... That for me was a very big mystery. Where was the real Juju? But the EFF did say something about Sona, about the president's speech. This fellow who claimed to be, and he looked like Julius Malema, spoke outside Parliament. And he said, Cyril cannot stop corruption. Because if he did, then he will have to lock up half of his cabinet. Wow, now that's something, eh? That sounds very much like what Julius would say. But there are others who say that Malema was very quiet because he is worried that the new director of the National Prosecuting of National Public Prosecution, Shamila Botoy, has got a big danda out for him. And maybe after the elections, she will go for him, and it may be brown bread and black tea for him for a long time. And also, people are saying, maybe that's why Ramaphosa is also not acting straight away, holding back a little bit to weed out the chorwans. He is waiting till after the elections when he is in a more powerful position to deal with them. If he took action right now, then it may cause some ruction, some upheaval in the ANC, because it seems that there are some pro-Zuma groups pushing for Zuma's guys, to remain in control where they are right now. Anyway, that's the talk in the souks. But Malema did respond outside Parliament to the question put to him by a TV fellow. Mr. Malema, you said that you will ask Ramaphosa about the 500,000 rands that he got from Bosasa for your election campaign. We expected you to make a big noise about this. You said nothing. Why not? And Malema gave an answer that convinced me that he was not the real Malema. He said, well, you see, the president went on ENCA TV and he explained about the 500,000 rands and also went to the public protector and explained everything. So it was not necessary to raise the issue in Parliament. Not necessary to raise the issue in Parliament. So I let it go. Let it go. Let it go. Juju, let it go. Hi, bo. Hey, this was not the real, this is Malema, eh? He would never let anything go. But wait. The EFF did in fact say something when Mr. Tumamina was delivering his speech. I will tell you that immediately after this break. Yes, welcome back. The program is called The Big Picture. Now, I was saying that Julius Malema was very, very meek and didn't say anything inside Parliament while Cyril Ramaphosa was speaking. But, in fact, someone did speak up, and that was Floyd Shivambu. He stood up on a point of order and said, "No, no, Speaker, this is plagiarism." What was Floyd referring to? What was it all about? What was this plagiarism that he was talking about? Well, Ramaphosa said, "We will give the learners in schools tablets within the next 6 years." Well, he was not thinking about giving them Panado or anything like that. Although I must say that some of the kids should be given something to make them more disciplined. Eh? I don't know. It's a jungle out there in some schools. Many teachers are at breaking point. Ill-discipline in some of the schools is at an amazing level. But I digress. Yes, Floyd Shivambu said that Ramaphosa was copying what the EFF said a week ago at its big rally, spelling out its policy. The EFF said at that time that it would give tablets to the learners. Ramaphosa said, he said the same thing as his government's policy. My dear friends, Cyril, in the speech said, in the very same speech also said, that 4,000 schools don't have appropriate sanitation facilities. Those are his words. You know, sometimes you've got to call a spade a spade. But our president said that 4,000 schools don't have appropriate sanitation facilities. And then he went on to explain that they are using pit toilets, these schools. I must remember that. Next time I want to leave a meeting or something and go to the toilet, excuse me, I am going to an appropriate sanitation facility. That should shock them and wonder what am I up to. I'm going to an appropriate sanitation facility. So, these people are using pit toilets. And Cyril Ramaphosa is going to fix it. Fix all of that. 4,000 schools. But hey, Cyril, you want to give these learners tablets. Good heavens. In fact, so many of our learners are hopeless at school. Remember the old days when we had arithmetic? Remember arithmetic? We had to learn times table. 1, 2, 2, 2, 2, 4, 3, 2, 6, or 5, 3, 15, 6, 3, 18, 7, 3, 21. Remember those days? Rote learning, it was called, I think. We had to learn times tables. Today, nothing is in the head. They use calculators. Reading and writing. I am told that some learners use WhatsApp spelling in the essays. Anyway, Cyril Bhai wants to give them tablets. While 4,000 schools have inappropriate sanitation facilities. How are we prioritizing? There's limited resources, limited money. Where's the money going to come for to get all these fancy things? How much does a tablet cost? 500, 600 rands? And you're going to give the students, the learners, all of this? While some children are using pit toilets? And all of this brings me to the big story. And it's also about toilets. If you remember last year, around December, I told you about a story I read in the papers that really shook me up and made me very angry. Briefly, it was about a rural school in the Transkei. There were two toilets for the teachers, one for males and one for females. And there was only one broken toilet seat available. And this was passed from one toilet to the other as it was required. Male toilet to the female toilet and so on. Well, the article said they had to ask, wait, hang on. What about the learners? What about the learners? The kids? Well, the article said they had to ask for the seat, this broken toilet seat, and put it over a hole in the ground. You know, I was shocked and angry, as you heard from my program last week. Shocked. 25 years into the new democracy, and we have kids subjected to this. That's absolutely horrible. And Ramaphosa in his speech even mentioned that two kids actually fell in this pitch, in the pitch toilets in other parts of the country and drowned, died. This is unforgivable. Right, so after the program on Monday, I got a call from Razak Musa of Willerton Oils. His wife heard my program and was deeply moved by what she heard. And Razak told me that in the new year we will go and have a look at the school and do something about this terrible situation. Well, I called the principal. Somehow I found his number, I googled it, and I called him, Mr. Bikitsha. And I told him that we were coming over to see what's happening there and fix the school up. And he was screaming and shouting and laughing, and he was just overjoyed. Overjoyed. So, on Thursday, this last Thursday, we flew to East London. We got a car there, and we drove for 3 hours into the heart of Transkei. Into the heart of Transkei, to a place called Ducha, Iducha. The excited principal was waiting there at the garage, and he jumped in with us and said that the school was only 45 kilometers away and it will take 1.5 hours to get 1.5 hours for 45 kilometers. That's very strange, I thought. Then I found out why. It was a rocky dirt road. Rocky is actually an understatement. I was sitting in the back seat. I thought I was on the inside of a washing machine. My kidneys fell out a few times. Razak wasn't playing, eh? Oh, he's a good driver. And he gave the RAV4 sticks, pushed it. No rocks, no nothing in his way. A few times I thought, this is it, khalas, as I read my du'as over and over again. But alhamdulillah, we finally made it to the school. And the school, a prefab structure built in 1980 or sometime, if I remember what the principal told me, huge holes in the walls, prefab, holes in the walls. And there were, I think, about 4 classrooms. Most window panes were missing. Rain and icy cold winds meant that some of the rooms could not be used. Icy cold. And that part of the country can be extremely cold. Icy wind and cold. Mr. Bigicha pointed to the 2 horrible outside toilets some distance away from the school for the teachers. There were no doors on the toilets. The toilets had no doors. Then I asked him very casually, where do the children go? And Mr. Bikitsha answered, in the bush. 200 kids use the bush. 200 kids use the bush. Well, we were told that the department promised to build toilets starting in April. Promises, promises, promises. So in the end, we decided that a brother who comes regularly from Durban to the area will assess the school's requirements and will report to us what's to be done. And of course, then we had to return from this rural area. The prospect of driving back on that rocky road with lazy cows and sheep and pigs around every corner, getting very cross with us as we hooted at them to move, made me wish we had a helicopter. But I must say, dear listeners, overall, it was quite an eye-opening trip for me to the deep rural area to witness how others live in such basic conditions, to say the least. And yet the children in their uniforms were full of smiles, sunshine faces, so cheerful and so full of enthusiasm to be educated under such difficult conditions. And of course, the company of Razak Musa was equally inspiring for me. The man is so full of wisdom, so full of wisdom. And now, let me leave the local scene and go and see what's happening on the international front. And every Saturday morning, when I look at the news, Al Jazeera, or go onto some websites, I'm absolutely depressed, horrified, shocked, and angered. Every week, as you know, there are huge demonstrations at the Gaza border with Israel. These people are in a sense of absolute despair, depression. They're living in an open prison. Again, I want to tell you that Gaza is tiny. How big is it? It's about 47 kilometers along the coast, along the sea, and about 6 or 7 kilometers wide. That's all. Tiny piece of land. It's an open-air prison, the largest open-air prison in the world. And you got about 2 million Palestinians living there under horrible conditions, facing dire health problems, lack of water and sanitation, of course, lack of food and medicine. It's under siege, is under sanctions by Israel. You can't even go out in your boats a certain distance to fish without the Israeli Navy shooting at you. So you have this wall, this fence along the Gaza border, and people, thousands of them every Friday, as you know, go and demonstrate. Most of them are refugees chased out of their homes in what is now Israel, and they want to go back to their homes. They want to go back, and they want to break out of this prison. So all they do is go and demonstrate at the border, keep the situation alive while they are half dead, to tell the world, we are here, we want to tell you that we are not going away. Don't forget us. Don't forget us. And thousands of them, young and old, come and demonstrate at that border. And on the other side of this fence are Israeli soldiers lying on the ground with high-powered rifles that can kill at a distance of 1 kilometer. They are in no danger from these demonstrators. No danger. These demonstrators, some of them are so frustrated, would so throw some stones at the soldiers, which hardly even reach them. In fact, I don't think they reach them at all, because the soldiers are so far away. And yet these soldiers with the high-powered rifles, sometimes you get tear gas thrown, and sometimes you get live ammunition fired from these high-powered rifles at these people demonstrating for their human dignity. That's what they are doing. Give us our dignity. That's all they want. And these soldiers, some of them young people, firing and killing. And every Saturday, when I look at the news, I am so horrified that this is allowed to happen, and the world is witnessing and not putting a stop to this. Why? Because Israel has the power in the United States to make sure that the real story doesn't reach the world. So the world is not doing anything about this. Let me read to you from the Al Jazeera website the latest atrocities. Headline: Two Palestinian teens killed by Israeli forces in Gaza. Hassan Shalabi, 14 years old. Did you get that? 14 years. If you have children of teenage years, or if you have grandchildren of 14, imagine one of them killed. Now, you got the news that one of them was killed in maybe an accident or something. But Hassan Shalabi, 14 years old, was murdered. And also Hamza Shetewi, 17 years old, were both shot by Israeli forces during the Gaza Strip's weekly protests. Two Palestinian youths were killed by Israeli fire on Friday during the weekly protest near the Israeli fence east of the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry in the besieged enclave said, reported by them. Hassan Shalabi, 14 years, was killed by Israeli occupation, live fire to the chest east of Khan Yunis refugee camp in the southern Gaza Strip. The ministry said, as thousands of Palestinians demonstrated along the heavily fortified frontier with Israel for the 46th week running. So 46 years they've been 46 weeks the demonstrations have been carrying on. Hamza Shetewi, 18 years old, was also killed after he was shot in the neck by Israeli forces. Another 17 Palestinians were shot at different protest sites along the fence, including two journalists and four medics. Two journalists were killed. What kind of danger did they pose to the Israeli forces on the other side? Four medics, medical personnel, were also shot. I don't know, where's this? What's this insanity, eh? What's this insanity? Shot two journalists and four medics. Were they terrorists? What about the 17 Palestinians who were also shot? Some of them losing their limbs, I'm sure, because this always happens. Shot so that a whole leg is gone forever. Forever. Or maybe an eye, or maybe an arm. Gone forever. For life, young people. Crippled for life. According to Palestinian news agency Iman, Israeli forces shot tear gas canisters at an ambulance and sprayed demonstrators with chemically enhanced sewage water east of Khan Yunis. What are they also firing over the fence? Chemically enhanced sewage water against these demonstrators. The Israeli army declined to comment on the death, but said 6,700 rioters and demonstrators had been protesting along the border. They said they were hurling rocks at the Israeli troops and towards the security fence, as well as a number of explosive devices that did not cross the fence, Israeli spokesman said. Israeli troops responded with riot dispersal means and fired according to standard operating procedure. Did you get that? Standard operating procedure. What was that? Firing live ammunition. You got a telescope, high-powered rifle, and you fire at these people. This is murder. This is a crime against humanity. Crime against humanity. How can it be allowed? I shout at my TV every Saturday morning when I come across this for the last 46 weeks. At least 248 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in the last 48 weeks, and the majority shot during protests, though others have been hit by tank fire. Can you believe it? Tank fire or air raids. More than 23,000 others have been wounded. Did you get that? 23,000 have been wounded, losing some part of their body. a leg gone here, an arm, an eye, disfigured for life. And in that time, in the same period, how many Israeli soldiers have been killed? How many? Guess, guess. Guess how many? Two. Did you get that? Two Israeli soldiers have been killed. 248 Palestinians killed and 23,000 marred for life, wounded, scarred for life. I don't know, this is crazy. This is just too crazy. Now, let's see what's happening. You know, just when you thought that the Khashoggi drama has been dying down, yesterday it resurfaced again in a very big way. A New York Times report said that the Saudi crown prince said some time ago that he would use a bullet on Khashoggi. This was a year before the murder. New York Times report, it intercepted that the CIA intercepted communication between Mohammed bin Salman and one of his aides, that he would use a bullet on Khashoggi 1 year before he was chopped up. And more drama, there is something called the Maginsky, if I recall correctly. Let me just see if that is right. The Magnitsky Act. What is that act? It says that the Congress can tell the President to investigate any human rights abuses anywhere in the world, if there is some evidence of this. And so, 120 days ago, they told Donald Trump to go and see and investigate the role that is played by Mohammed bin Salman in the murder of Khashoggi. And he had the 120 day deadline according to the Magnitsky Act. And yesterday, the deadline expired. And now, well, Donald Trump did nothing about it. Nothing. So this is more drama about this Khashoggi affair. Lots of things happening around that, and I'm happy that it is, because it must not just go away. United Nations is now investigating, and one of its investigators has said that all fingers point to the fact that people high up in the Saudi government had something to do with the Khashoggi killings. Right, last 2 minutes left, and it's time for light at the end of the tunnel. And I've been too busy with my eyes to look for anything for you, so I'm going to give you some recycled ones. Put some danya on it, okay? Gulambai said, "Hey, Ronnie, you're looking very bad, eh? What happened? You got all those blue eyes and all that." And Ronnie said, "Hey, Gulu, what I must tell you, man, I was at my mother-in-law's funeral last week. When they lowered her coffin into the grave, the priest asked if anyone wants to throw something in that we would like her to take to the grave with her. And I did what the priest asked. And you know what, Ronnie? It took Pushpa 20 minutes to climb out of the grave." Oh, man, I'm always speaking about Ronnie. I always speak about Ronnie from Mirbank. And he, as you know, gets into serious trouble with his fro Pushpa and ends up in ICU. Well, this time, it was his best friend Gulambai who got into trouble with his wife Gori Bibi. Hey, you know what? That's one hell of an auntie, eh? Very big size. And very tough. Big size and tough, Gulambai's fro. Her nickname is Patan Poopy. And Gulambai is thin, very mar. And he's tall like a biltong. And Gulambai and Gori Bibi just came back from a holiday in Dubai. And Ronnie met Gulambai at the Mirbank tea room. And Gulambai was on crutches and a big swollen ear. And Ronnie said, "Hey, Gulam, what happened, bro? You had an accident and all?" And Ghulam Bhai said, "Hey, what I must tell you, Ronnie, my fro and I were having a lekker time in Dubai. Then one day, one rich Arab fella came to us in the mall, and he looked at my fro and he said, 'Brother, your wife is very beautiful. If you leave her and let me marry her, I will give you 1,000 camels.'" Ronnie said, yeah. "And then what happened, man? What happened?" And Ghulam Bhai replied, "Well, I thought about it for a minute. And then I told this Arab guy, 'Hey, bro, you can stick your 1,000 camels. This is my fro. This is my wife. I will never leave her.'" Then we went back to the hotel. And my fro was so happy. And she said, "Kullu, my darling, I'm so happy that you told that man off. I didn't know you love me so much. But tell me, what you were thinking before you gave him your answer?" So I replied to her, "Darling, I told him no, because I was thinking, what a big job to take 100 camels back to Durban. She took me with a hell of a club, man, and I fell down the steps, man." This is A.B. Dawji repeating you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And see, listeners, I will see you on the other side on Radio Al-Ansar after the 12 o'clock news.